Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Merlin to my dark and the bite to my bark, it's Dan.
Good evening, Scott.
It is a good evening, and I'm glad that we're actually starting while it's still evening. We often seem to start these podcasts post-midnight, as one of our STV squad members likes to mock us with. Before we go...
Not tonight.
Yeah, screw up. Oh, look at that once again, an F-bomb in the first minute.
45 seconds.
Nice. So before we go any further, let's introduce the rest of the STVD All-Star Squad. First, our small-town girl living in a lilac world, it's Vicky.
Hey, y'all.
Hey, y'all.
I said hey, y'all.
We're going to say y'all, and we're going to say you're countrified for the evening. Next, we have our chatterbox from the Burr himself, Cade.
Guten Abend, everybody.
Good lord. Are you part of the new regime now? Anyway. And finally, from the City of Beautiful Churches, which maybe explains all that time on his knees, it's Jason.
Hello there. I'm the D in the STVD.
Wow.
Dear Lord.
You know what? Considering how many things that D could stand for, I'm going to have to agree with that assessment. well done, Jason.
Thank you so much.
Now, in the last couple podcasts, we've led off with, you know, a bunch of little news items about stuff that's happening or about to happen. I think we're going to keep that fairly brief this time because we've got a lot to say about the four shows this week. Plus, we also, you know, stay tuned with us, ye who may bail out after, you know, Legends or Flash or whatever, because we have an all-new segment coming up after we cover the four shows. But there are a few things maybe we want to mention before we get to those shows. For one, there's yet a Powerless premiere tonight, and there's another new show coming on next week. Right, Dan? Is that when it is?
Yeah, it starts next Wednesday night. The FX series Legion, which, you know, deals with X-Men related stuff, but not, doesn't look like too crazy like we're expecting. So it looks pretty good and interesting so far. Plus, you know, one of our people is making it.
Our people. I love it. True. One of our favorite creators on television. I really like the ads for that. And, you know, it almost pains me to say it because I'm not the biggest fan of the X-Men franchise, but that show really looks like it may be a winner. So hopefully it will be. I did not get a chance to watch Powerless tonight. So maybe when we record next week, I might pop on with an opinion about that. There's been a few other things that have happened movie-wise. Ben Affleck is now no longer going to direct the solo Batman film, so there's a lot of hot rumors about who will. I understand it would have been pretty hard to direct while you're wearing that stupid Batman outfit, so, you know, I don't blame him for backing out of it. And also, for the Aquaman movie, which is fast becoming the superhero property I'm most looking forward to for some reason, word was this week they actually cast the villain Black Manta. He's going to be played by the actor, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, Yahya Abdul-Mateen from The Get Down, who seems like he's going to be in a whole bunch of movies over the next couple of years, so he's pretty much going to be everywhere, I think, this guy. And you can tell from that silence how excited everybody is about both those news items, so we're just going to move on. What? You going to say something? You're just going to go, eh?
That's yay.
All right. Well, we had four big shows this week, so let's just get to them. And let's kick off things with Supergirl, We Can Be Heroes. Well, first things first, let's give you the 2-minute recap of the episode. Supergirl's closest thing to an arch nemesis, Livewire, apparently escapes from prison, and Supergirl is hell-bent on catching her before untold extras are killed. Mon-El, who's in superhero training while being dressed more like he's a hero on Smallville, tags along, but he's clearly more interested in saving Supergirl than a bunch of cops. Fortunately for them, this universe's twisted version of the Dark Knight, where they get the hero they don't deserve and definitely don't need, the Guardian, shows up to help him out, which leads to Kara finally finding out that there is clearly not much work involved in being the interim CEO at CatGo Worldwide, since James Olsen is spending all his time running around as the Guardian. However, the big twist here is that Livewire didn't escape so much as she was abducted from prison by some psycho-scientist who is using her as a human battery to power up his own brand of super soldiers, including himself. So, all sorts of fights ensue involving Mon-El and the Guardian. Then Supergirl shows up and makes a very temporary truce with Livewire. Everybody cleans house at the latest in a long line of evil lairs that are abandoned warehouses. Meanwhile, we are also reminded that the DEO is even more screwed up than Star Labs when it comes to things like, you know, due process or lawful interment, because Megan has apparently been in a cell there for who knows how long, days, weeks, months, who knows. But she gets ill from some sort of mysterious psychic attack, and in order to save her, John must do a Vulcan mind, a Martian psychic bond with her to enter her consciousness. And he finds out that she wasn't like the rest of the the white Martians, and in fact rebelled against her own kind. Which means she turned out to be okay. So John says, yeah, we don't need to keep you in a cage for no real reason anymore. But one little thing, that psychic attack turns out to be a sign that the white Martians are coming to Earth. Finally, back to Kara, who I think is going to be our lead topic for this segment. After affirming she's not on board with the whole James and Wynn doing their superhero thing, Mon-El shows up at her place and confesses he does remember that kiss with her, and he also has romantic feelings for her. But, you know, he's cool with just working with her as super friends, because, you know, that plan always works out really well. So, that's the recap. Let's get to the actual discussion here. And this is one time I really think we should start off just talking about the main character, Supergirl herself. This is a very interesting episode. The more I thought about it, the more I realized how more interesting or fully realized that the character of Supergirl is this season than she was at the stage in the first season. She's pretty flawed, as even Dan likes to jokingly point out. But I think that also helps make her a bit more interesting. So let's hear what you guys have to say about this, and let's start off with Cade.
Her flaws, it's one of those things, because I think you can point it out, like when a lot of people hear people complain about Superman, they'll talk about how perfect Superman is, how it's hard to relate to that character because he's a god. The show, by giving Kara not that godlike persona, showing she has problems, makes her a far more relatable character for someone who basically should be a god to humans. So having her have drawbacks that aren't physical, but like the way she behaves around people, the way she interacts with people, how she sees herself and others, and like basically saying, no, you can't be heroes, I can be a hero, you're not really allowed to be a hero, makes her personable instead of just this superhero that you can have no connection with because she's from another world, she has all these powers. So it helps, it definitely makes a better TV show if you have her have flaws like that, because then it gives you chances where you can either make people relate to the character or go, I don't relate to her, but you can relate to someone else in the interaction with her.
That makes a lot of sense. Vicky, do you agree with that or do you see it a different way?
I agree with a lot of what I said. It definitely makes her a lot more interesting because, you know, a lot of people see Superman as, you know, very boring because he's this near perfect, being. But then we see her, it gives her character because we see, you know, her prejudices against, you know, the Daxamites with Mon-El, and this whole thing about her against the vigilantes and everything. So, yeah, it definitely just makes the show that much better.
Yeah, I agree. Uh-huh. Mm.
That's my favorite one.
I think that's how it's going to go, isn't it? Is that how it's going to go tonight? Just mm-hmm, yeah, I agree. Just kind of chime in as well.
I genuinely agree with that. And, you know, it just makes me love her more for whatever bizarre reason.
Oh, she's attractive. What can you say?
Yeah, well, she's more attractive when she's being racist. So I guess I just blown with a political wind. So
there you go.
Such good points. just for an example, as what Cade and Vicky were saying, it was not just the Daxamites, but as she was not so on board with her sister being attracted to Maggie. But you know, she evolved during the episode and she came around to that. You know, that's just one way of showing her flaws right there.
Well, yeah, interesting to bring that up. But I like the fact that, you know, they could have just made the series be like, oh, she's just learning how to use her powers and maybe she screws up that way from time to time. But I like the fact that it's more about how she's interacting with people. And there are things that she maybe doesn't either. Like the stuff with her sister, maybe she had never, well, she had never been exposed to anything like that. It never even occurred to her before. So it was more shock and surprise and how do I deal with this and how do I react to it? With what she does in this episode, moving beyond her Daxamite racism, it's more, you know, we ended up getting probably one of the best scenes with James Olsen that this show has had. And I've not been a fan of this character on the show since the pilot, quite frankly. But when he pretty much tells her, you know, she doesn't have the right to tell him what to do, and or the right to say that who made her, you know, the person in charge of who decides to be, who gets to be a hero or not. She doesn't, her cousin might have that right, but she certainly doesn't. I know he doesn't, but you know what I mean. So, and even though I'm not a big fan of the whole Guardian storyline, in that moment I was like, yeah, that's right. Shut up. So, I like the fact that they take a character who is so easily likable because of the actress, because of just the nature of her character, and they let her have these moments and these attitudes, which we don't necessarily associate with likability. The way she speaks to these people, the way her thought process. If this had been someone else, if this had been on Arrow and been Ollie doing this kind of crap, which doesn't sound too far removed from, quite frankly, we would have been saying, oh, there he goes again. But on this show, it's more, oh, this is interesting. It makes her, it gives shadings to a character that would be just a bright light and nothing else, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, unintentional segue, but hey, speaking of bright lights, let's move on to our second topic of the episode, which is really about Livewire. And, you know, the overall plot for this episode, dealing with, you know, Livewire escaping from prison, but then it turns out she's more victim than villain for a good chunk of the episode. And, you know, she is really, I guess on this series, really has been the closest thing we have to an arch nemesis for her. So, Jason, what do you have to say about Livewire? I have a feeling you might have a few things to say here.
Well, if you didn't know that she was an arch nemesis, you damn sure know that you know by this episode, because they hit you over the head with it a couple times. Like, oh, she's Supergirl's arch nemesis. She's Supergirl's arch nemesis. It's like, okay, we get it. We get it now. This is going to be the girl that's going to always be bedeviling Kara. I especially like the fact that she get Kara threw in, like, she thought it'd be fun to have an arch nemesis, but, you know, it turned out not so much. You know, she gets to show up once or twice a year. I gotta say that the actress is okay. You know, she's all right.
Right.
What were you gonna say? What were you gonna say, Scott?
No, I was laughing at either your exaggerated sigh or breath there during your commentary.
Yeah, I had to sit there and I had to reel myself back in because my brain was starting to get ahead of my mouth, as it wants to do sometimes.
Oh,
but okay.
That's fascinating insight. Yeah,
and we heard the physical process actually happening. With
yeah. And the whole thought that she was captured by a generic mad scientist, I kind of love that. And he played the over-the-top mad scientist part perfectly.
Yeah. That, I've seen that actor on a number of things, and he's always kind of a silly, fun actor.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually his name listed in the credits, is Mad Scientist.
Good, because I neglected to go look up his his name when I was doing the writing up the recap, so I'm glad he didn't actually have a name.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think we ever actually heard a name for him.
Well, you know, this show, they don't like naming people unless they really have to eventually. Like, we didn't, they didn't name, you know, Mama Luther until like four episodes in, but I guess there was a reason for that. Just briefly, building on what Jason was sort of saying about the arch nemesis, putting his snark aside, that actually gave us a really kind of fun moment with Kara, because if there's one thing that her cousin's known for, it's, yeah, he's got himself an arch nemesis or two, you know, which because when you think of Superman, you think of Lex Luthor and so on and so forth. Supergirl, I don't know if I, pre this show, I would really have thought of anyone being specifically an arch nemesis for her. And I mean, I'm sure there are, but just not no one that's really all that iconic, comparatively speaking. So I like the fact that they kind of established that on this show. So well done. Cade, I know that you're kind of a Livewire fan, or is that Silver Banshee you're more of a fan of now that I think about it?
Both, actually. Well, Livewire was like really exciting because I didn't think we'd get her on the series because she was kind of a Superman villain. But having her early, I also like that they've basically, this is him saying, we'll get to see more of her. I do like that it's not going to be, are we going to have more Livewire? We know we are. So she'll pop back in, she'll cause chaos as she does, and then we'll disappear again. It's good that, because really, I don't know if the other CW shows really have set up like a villain type like that we know is sticking around. We've seen some, and you could kind of say Captain Cold, but she's much more being in line to be that recurring villain for Kara that we haven't had so far for her.
And well, that's good. Kind of had that with Merlin on Arrow.
Okay, that's true. But Malcolm's also been, I'll be a hero for 5 minutes. I'll be a villain for 5 minutes. So he's just been a recurring character at this point.
He's so good.
He's great.
But we'll be talking about that to cause chaos.
And it's funny that you should bring that up, because maybe that would be something that would have helped improve the Flash over the last couple of seasons if, instead of just recycling these, not recycling, totally not the right word at all, just these horrible villain of the weeks that turn out to be just waste of time, you know, your Chicade and others. I would prefer that they, you know, hey, why don't you bring back some of the more iconic, better villains, and you can, even if you use them in a limited way, they already have an established origin and they already have been established on the show, so you don't need to spend as much time with them in that regard. So you could get away with bringing back, say, I don't know, bring back Captain Boomerang on this show. He was only in that stupid crossover for 5 minutes, but he's a huge Flash villain. Or any, where is Golden Glider? What happened to her?
They like to mention her, but you don't see her.
Right. So
that's all what they do on the Flash, particle accelerator spamming.
The pass effect. Nice. Anyway, wow, why am I talking about the Flash when we're supposed to be talking about Supergirl? So let's get to the next topic. And if I missed anyone on this one, feel free to bring it up when we're talking about the next thing as well. That other storyline, which was the John Jones one. You know, basically the White Martians are coming. And which I think is going to happen in at least in the next episode. I don't know if it's going to be more of an ongoing storyline beyond that. But I was somewhat interested in this. I thought they handled it reasonably well, although the fact that they had Megan, you know, locked up all this time is kind of weird the more you think about it. Vicky, what did you think of how the whole Martian storyline was handled?
Initially, I was like, okay, where are they going with this? You know, if there was kind of a point to them having this storyline in the episode. But then with the payoff at the end, her saying, you know, that the White Martians are coming, I'm like, oh, okay, that was a really good way to do that then. So I, like, you know, I was initially kind of like, you know, what I thought it was initially pointless, but it paid off well.
Yeah, I think they just had to find a way to resolve the relationship between those two characters. I don't think it was handled all that elegantly for this show. I think they should have done something a bit better with her than, you know, the whole weird, she's been locked in a cell all this time. But I do agree where it got to, which was finding out about her backstory and that the White Martians are coming. I think those are two really positive outcomes of what would have otherwise been kind of a head-scratching storyline for the episode. So kind of, I'd rather it start off shitty and well than the other way around. So, I was fine with it.
I was going to concur with that I did not like the beginning part of it. I did not like the setup for it, but I liked the payoff in the end because much like the way they did Flash last episode, it gave a blueprint as to where the season was going to go. We have something to look forward to now, a threat.
Right, and hopefully we'll see John in John Jones mode as opposed to his human side. But depends how much money they have to spend on the episode with the CGI and everything. I guess
I have to say I didn't like his reaction to how she was a white Martian, how he would never help her out, and then 20 minutes later he was all, "I'll help her out."
Well, the show is all as Dan has pointed out. The show is all about we're already following one racist, so why not have another? But you know what?
Have something for the ladies.
But you know what? When I made a very mild and lame joke in the recap earlier when I made a reference to the white Martians as though they were Nazis. But if you continue that analogy, because John looks at his race, the Green Martians, as the way they were being exterminated or wiped out by them. If this was someone who was a Jew and just ran into a Nazi, someone who's a member of the Nazi Party some years after World War II, probably wouldn't be his or her biggest fan, and it might take a little bit to get over that until you're shown the truth. And once he was shown the truth about her, then he could accept her. So, yeah, was it a little fast? Maybe, but. I would have been troubled if he saw the truth and then still acted as though he resented her. So I'm kind of glad they kind of fixed that up and we can move on from here. So is there anything else about this episode anyone wants to say before we move on to the grades?
I've got nothing else.
I thought it was nice to actually see James Olsen and not think the character was just a complete waste of time. Like, he actually, had the moral upper ground for once and was useful. And, they used what they've been doing with him as a guardian, and actually, in a good way for once. Right. So that was nice to see. And hopefully they can continue that.
I think this was his best episode, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah, from what I've seen, definitely.
Oh, agree with that.
That's right. You were spared a few, if I recall. Or more than a few.
I only watched the first two episodes of season one and the Flash one.
There you go. All right, then let's get to those scorecards. So, Vicky, what did you think of this week's Supergirl?
I'll give it a 4.
Cade?
3.5.
Jason?
3.5.
Dan?
I'm also 3.5.
I'm going to go with Vicky and give it a 4. And I don't even know why.
You want to introduce a ray of sunshine into your life.
That's what that must be, because my life is a dark abyss right now. So, next up is The Flash, Dead or Alive. Okay, once again, let's lead off with the two-minute recap. A collector has arrived from Earth-19 looking for H.R. Wells. It's a metahuman named Gypsy with powers similar to Vibe, only she appears more focused and deadly than Cisco has ever been. We also find out that interdimensional travel has been banned on Earth-19, and the punishment for breaking that law is death. So she tracked down H.R. to Earth-1 because apparently he had been sending back the stories he's been writing, essentially casting himself as the main hero in the adventures of Team Flash. I think I missed the part in the episode that explained how he was able to transmit these stories back through time and space to Earth-19. Maybe someone can fill me in later. Who cares? Not important. Because it looks like HR is going to die. So maybe we might get back one of the more interesting Wells on the show. I don't know. Paging Earth-2. Anyway, Well, Wally is fitting in more and more as not just a wannabe sidekick, but a hero all on his own. Julian, however, is not fitting in quite as well personality-wise, but at least he's already made more contributions to the team than both HR and Caitlin combined have this season. And playing throughout the episode is the ticking clock on Iris. It's not easy to know you're slated to die in 4 months, so she's trying to leave her mark by being the Lois Lane of Central City rather than Lois Lame. Barry and Joe both get a little chauvinistically condescending towards her, because, you know, reporters should never chase dangerous stories. Maybe there's a nice flower show she can cover or something, or maybe recipes. What is the name of that newspaper? Is it Central City Gazette? I don't know what it's called. Who cares? Back to Gypsy and Cisco, they eventually have to put their fun flirting aside, okay, and battle each other, warping through the multiverse, including, at one point, Supergirl's Earth. Was that Earth 38? Is that the designation they gave that one? I think it was. As well as an Earth that looked a lot like the place where Obi-Wan and Anakin fought in Revenge of the Sith. Very strange. Cisco wins, but it's Earth 1 rules here, so it ain't to the death after all. So by the end, Gypsy heads back to Earth 19 with a BS story about executing HR, as well as a couple duffel bags filled with coffee. And I guess more importantly, series-wise, after it's finally clear you can't simply depend on changing events before the night of Iris's murder and hoping that'll be what changes that fact, maybe she can be saved on that actual night. And if Barry can't get up to speed to do it, maybe Wally can. So, our first topic, let's talk about Gypsy and Cisco. You know, who Gypsy, I guess, she, any other time you'd say she's like the villain of the week, but she's not really a villain, so I'm not really sure what we call her here. Though comic book fans know Gypsy as a hero, just like Vibe, so we've got that to talk about here. Well, let's talk about that, including all the other stuff connected to that storyline here, especially a lot of the HR stuff. So let's lead off with Vicky this time around. Vicky, what did you think of Gypsy and all that stuff?
I thought it was pretty. I thought it was really cool because, you know, you see someone who has same powers as Cisco, but just way more advanced and way more powerful. It was so awkward, cute how he was like subtly trying to flirt with her and totally not being subtle about it.
Was they subtle?
No, he was trying to be and totally not being. They kind of left the door open that we could, you know, possibly see her again, which I think is awesome.
See, I figured you might be upset because you're still probably pining for Cisco to get back together with the Hawkgirl chick. So,
no.
Where there was actually a glimmer of chemistry between these two as opposed to that one. So. Jason, I know you're familiar with Gypsy, the character from the comic, so what did you think of how they handled this CW version of her?
She's okay, but she's nothing like the comics at all. Just totally different power sets.
Right. Do you like the comic book character, by the way?
Not particularly, no.
Yeah, me neither.
At least not when she first appeared, because she was just, I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Not interesting at all. I mean, it just kind of describes that whole era of the Justice League at that time. But anyway, that's comics, not the show. But I happen to enjoy the Cisco HR dynamic this episode. I mean, we've had before them clashing in the past. It was nice to see Cisco actually step up and try to help HR and save him from death this time, you know, actually as a friend, to be a friend and not an antagonist against him.
So does that mean so you bought into it then? Because
yes.
All right. It's interesting.
I feel like they work together long enough now, you know, that they've got some kind of relationship just beyond antagonism to each other.
All right. That, you know what? That's a valid point. It's not like it's only been one or two episodes at this point. So, and how long can you keep going, you know, hitting the same notes between those two? So.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of dynamics, it's nice to see Julian involved with the team.
Yeah, although that's another situation where I hope that the way he was in this episode and the whole lack of, you know, being able to connect to people doesn't become just the kind of the rote thing episode after episode. That's kind of a problem on the show with certain characters where they just keep hitting the same beats over and over as opposed to letting them evolve. So I'm hoping there's a bit more done with his character in future episodes.
He dropped a couple insults and he was out.
Yeah, pretty much. Dan, did you have any kind of opinions on how this part of the episode was handled?
Sorry, it took me a second to unmute. I thought it was well done. I like the guest star, and I thought she did a good job. And you know, I pretty much agree with what the other guys have been saying, even Jason.
Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome.
I think one thing that's kind of interesting about this episode, that in a lot of ways this might have been, you know, a borderline filler kind of an episode, but I didn't mind it, and it focused a lot on like the Cisco Gypsy relationship as opposed to really pushing anything story-wise with Barry forward, and I didn't mind that either. So it's an episode that I went into, and as it was first unfolding, I was kind of iffy on, but as it played out, I was like, you know, I'm enjoying this more than I thought I would. Or maybe I'm just so used to being negative about The Flash lately. My expectations have been sufficiently lowered for the show, which is not a good thing, but whatever. Let's move on to the next topic of choice here, which really should be about Iris. The fact that she's, you know, trying to make a name for herself. And then the fact that Wally, how much Wally has evolved or has progressed from what he was, you know, just a few episodes ago in this episode. So I want to talk a bit about that, as well as, you know, how Barry really deals with both of those characters, because obviously he's a catalyst for a lot of actions with those characters in most episodes, although not necessarily as much in this episode. So, Cade, what were your feelings on these members of the West family?
I'm enjoying their storyline this season a lot more than, say, last season. I like this Iris going after people, weapons dealers who are being problematic, bringing terrible things in. Her chasing that story is much more believable than her chasing some guy running a street racing league like last season, which was ludicrous. And you're like, why did she put herself in that bad situation? That you thought was dumb, because I'm like, that story's... This point, though, her putting herself in danger here, you're like, I can understand it, because you're trying to do something. You're not just trying to tell a story. You're trying to make the city safer, but you're doing it through telling your story, being a journalist. And I liked her bringing Wally in because she heard the story of them being a team in the other world, realizing her brother has powers. Let me bring him in. He can be helpful, because that's someone who's showing faith in Wally with his powers, which very few of them have done so far. Much more in this episode, you really get to see them believing in Wally. But that's Iris. Like, I believe in my brother. I believe he can help me in this situation if I'm in danger. And he did. And it was, that was nice to see those two bonding together and having faith in each other and believing in each other. Even if Wally was hesitant, he did go with his sister. He did give her enough faith to go with her and help her out. And it's nice to see characters on this show going, I believe you can do this. Let's do this together. Because sometimes they're very much, I don't think you can do this. I'll help you because I have to, but I don't really think you can pull this off like they were with Cisco. Whereas these two believe that the other can do those things and believe by working together we can accomplish something.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Huh. Maybe they're religious family. They just have more faith. I don't know. Dan, what did you think about the brother and sister here?
Yeah, Cade was pretty much on point there. I definitely appreciated the way they handled this. And it was kind of, it was good how they brought back what happened with them in Flashpoint, because it was kind of fun with a little of it we saw. And how they proceeded from that was, you know, a little bit smarter than the show tends to do. I mean, yeah, right. She was a little bit reckless, but they weren't like, hey, look at everybody. She's going to die soon. She must have a death wish. Let's just milk the fuck out of that, like, cliched crap. But they didn't do that. So it was just, you know, it was really, really nice and effective and
right.
Better than I would expect from the first third of the season.
Yeah. I mean, she has that one moment with the gun runner or a drug runner, whatever the heck he is, when she goes right up to him with the gun, puts it up against her chest, whatever, which is a little bit out there. But for whatever reason, I felt it kind of worked surprisingly.
Well, it makes sense because she pretty much
she knows she's going to be alive.
Yeah, I think she thinks she's going to die at that point. I think it kind of makes me think that she doesn't think like they're going to be able to save her, and that's her time. Right. So I think, you know, it kind of, it makes sense. Just like, oh, you know, I'm going to die 5 weeks from now. Do whatever the hell you want. It's not going to happen. So I thought that that wasn't, you know, it wasn't so much a, like, you know, go ahead and kill me, I'm dead anyway thing. It was more just like a, no, this isn't when I die thing.
Exactly. I agree.
It's cool.
It was less death wishy and more heroic, I thought. I'll also say the actress and the character got one of their better moments on the show when she has her little breakdown with Barry about, it's not just simply that she's afraid to die. She's afraid to die and not have made a difference, not have left her mark. I can very much relate to that. I'll be honest with you, I've actually even had that thought about my own life, and I bet there's a lot of people who at certain points in their lives feel that way as well. The fact that she knows that she may die in a few months and maybe she doesn't see herself as having accomplished anything to leave behind. I just thought that was a surprisingly powerful moment in a storyline I thought would be more not throwaway, but just I'd be like bored by. So I'll give Candace Patton a lot of credit for that. She's gotten
That was very relatable.
Okay. So is there anything else anyone wants to say about this episode before we move on to the scorecards here?
I like to say I like the fight between Gypsy and Cisco. That was fun.
Yeah, that was freaking awesome.
Thank you. We should mention from this episode on, one of the interesting aspects of this week in the CW shows is there was a lot of interconnection between the shows this week. So
yes, there was.
The fact that during the Vibe Gypsy fight that they end up in, you know, Supergirl's universe, which, in case we didn't know, you know, we even get a little bit of the Supergirl theme thrown in there, if I recall. And we got a cameo from a character from that show. I think that was Miss Tessmacher.
That was, yeah.
So we did get a little crossover there, and in a couple of the other shows we're going to be talking about, we had other little moments. So I really love that they are able to do that now. And one more thing that's not just specific to this episode, but just in general, which for some reason I thought of more after watching this episode than earlier on in the season, the fact that I think it's pretty clear that Vibe or Cisco does have this ability, which gives them just one more way to go from Earth to Earth, whatever, in addition to some device they could have sworn they had, whatever. Just the fact that is going to make it that much easier to get away with having the Supergirl universe interact with this one, you know, not just once a year, perhaps, really makes me happy. It really makes me glad that Supergirl is on the CW, and that they found a way around, which would have been a difficult situation to explain. I really like that they're able to do that with the show, with all these shows as a result.
Just reminds me of why I like comics so much as a kid, that they could do stuff like that.
Yeah, and you can get away with it in a comic because, you know, you can just explain it in a panel. We're all like, oh, we don't care, fine. Cool, now I know how Captain Marvel and Superman meet each other. But in a TV show, it takes forever to really try to work that out. And I like that they have that ironed out at this point, and we can have them, you know, bouncing back and forth all the time, which is what's going to happen even later this season, I believe.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Okay, so let's move on to those scorecards. Vicky, what was your take on, or grade, I should say, for this episode of The Flash?
I'll give it a 4.
Okay.
I'm going to give a Flash episode a 4.
JC?
It gets a 4.
Interesting.
I think that's the highest one I've given Flash in a while.
I think it is. You've been extra mean a couple times.
I have been.
And Dan?
Well, I really enjoyed the episode. I appreciate the fact that somehow they managed to have Cisco have chemistry with like all these female actresses, which they don't tend to do well on these shows, but they managed to keep doing that well. So I was half surprised they didn't end up making out while like flipping around dimension. So it was a fun episode. I'll give it a 4.5.
Wow, nice.
I've been down on the Flash this year, but it's been turning around for me.
Yeah, I'm starting to have a degree of hope for the show, which is nice. I'm also going to be positive about it, not not to the degree you were, but I'm going to join the STV Dears over there, and especially D. And I'm also going to give it a 4. Okay, then. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Next, we are going to be talking about Legends of Tomorrow, the Legion of Doom. Well, like I said, the title of this episode was The Legion of Doom, which is entirely appropriate, because even though this episode does juggle a couple other storylines, the primary focus is truly on the Legion of Doom, namely Damian Dark, Malcolm Merlyn, and the unfortunately not-so-alliterative Eobard Thawne. Because we not only get confirmation on the motivations of Merlyn, who wants to change his past, and Dark, who wants to change his future, but we find out what's actually driving Eobard Thawne. Not just why he wants the Spear of Destiny, but why he needs help retrieving it. Which in turn kind of tells us what really happened due to the end of Season 1 of The Flash. As well as some of the results and consequences about what happened at the end of Season 2 of The Flash. So really enjoying an amazing amount of interconnectivity here. We will be talking about the specifics of all that in more detail shortly. You know, this trio will be our number one topic of discussion for sure. But suffice to say, we end up with clearly defined reasons for what the so-called Legion of Doom is up to. And even though they're the bad guys, each of them actually has motivations that are, good lord, understandable. As opposed to some villains that we've encountered on the CW superhero shows, whose reasons for their actions tend to be questionable. So throughout this episode, we see the origins of how they formed their little cabal, and then how it's starting to fall apart with the infighting between Dark and Merlyn, and the superior-than-thou attitude of Thawne when he actually bothers to show up. This plays out over a caper in 2025 when they're trying to get the contents of Rip Hunter's safety deposit box, in which they believe he hid the rest of the Spear of Destiny, but instead it turns out he left, well, himself there, or to be more precise, a gizmo that has all the memories and neural pathways and highways and whatnot of Rip Hunter's actual brain, his intelligence, his personality, the whole kit and caboodle that makes Rip, Rip. As for the legends themselves, well, Martin has to face the music when bringing his time aberration of a daughter on board the Wave Rider. You know, she's there to help figure out a way to make a mystical amulet that's thousands of years old, interact, and essentially download into an artificial intelligence from the future. She finds out from Mr. I Don't Give a Flying Fig about anyone other than myself, Mick, that she's an even bigger mistake than the usual way kids end up happening. So that would be our emotional storyline for this week, with some real heavy lifting from Victor Garber and the actress Christina Brucato, who plays Lily Stein. And what's everyone else in the episode doing? Well, they're working on the mystery of who the hell the other speedster is, and they finally logically reason out that it must be Eobard Thawne, i.e. the Reverse Flash. I don't know why no one suggests dropping by Central City to let Barry know, but, you know, he's probably busy moping or something. So, there you go. That's a shorthand version of this episode. Oh, except that Thawne effectively reprograms Rip Hunter by the end, and we see Rip showing up in 1776 and apparently shooting George Washington. So there's your quickie recap. Let's move on to our first topic of discussion, which, as I said, is going to be the Legion of Doom.
For any of you guys watching the episode, and not you, Kate, because last week, since you were too busy at a strip club in the shitty part of Louisiana town to participate, you might not know what I'm talking about, but while watching it, were any of you guys thinking about how I was ranting and raving, how like they've barely used the Legion, these guys, like, they haven't been leaning on them too heavily, and then like this whole episode was like just them?
Yeah, I thought that was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I just thought it was ironic that I just got done talking about how great it is that they're barely using them, and then they just totally use them.
They're like, what did that Dan guy say? Let's do the exact opposite. And, oh my God, we ended up with the best episode ever. Anyway,
go ahead.
Cade, what was your take on the Legion of Doom throughout this episode?
It was fantastic for the very fact that these three have been characters on the other shows we've seen. We've enjoyed every time they're on. Matthew Lesher's Reverse Flash, as good as Harrison Wells' Reverse Flash was, his Reverse Flash is Eobard Thawne. He embodied it. He plays it up every time. He's perfect. He's always got that menace, those little tricks he does. Like when he just speeds real quickly into Rip's face to get him to talk, it's a fantastic maneuver. The fact he thinks he's better than the other two the entire time is really a really reverse Flash thing to do. Eobard Thawne does think he's better than everyone, and they're playing that perfectly. But it's good because you have two people who don't like playing second to anybody with Malcolm and Damian Dark. And the fact they're being treated like henchmen, like they talk about, that would drive those two crazy. And it did. And to get to see the interplay between them outside of like an Arrow storyline or like just past storylines, seeing them interact with each other here, the scene where they just started fighting with each other because they're League of Assassins. And it's like, this is how we settle things. It was good. This episode had so much good while being so bad because of how these people are. But you find out who they are. You know who they are. We have actual villains this season who not being just villains to be evil. They're being villains because they have a purpose. They want to be alive. They want to have a past. And one of them just doesn't want to be ripped apart for eternity and never seen again. When it's revealed that Thawne is being chased by the Black Flash, it's one of those moments you're like, that would get him to do everything he can to never have that happen again. This is something he knows he can't outrun. So what he does is not what he's used to doing is not the way he's got to beat it. He's got to do something differently, which would make perfect sense why he would even try to get help, why he would even think to do anything outside of just doing what he usually does in those situations and fight it off and kill it. He can't. So seeing them come together and at the end being a worse group by the fact that they are a unified group makes things a lot more interesting as the season goes along.
Yeah, absolutely. I would jump in here, but I'd rather let Jason go next. Jason, you want to build on that?
As Scott touched on during the recap, you get that connectivity to the Flash, which I absolutely loved. What did happen to Eobard Thawne as he disintegrated? Well, it turns out that he was being chased by the Black Flash. And I liked how they connected it to Flashpoint, the Flashpoint Flash, Eobard Thawne. That's where he was. He's still moving. I liked how you could just follow his story progression from show to show. I love that. I love the fact that Malcolm and Dark are in this episode doing what they do. And are they hamming it up? Of course. Do we love it? Of course.
Right.
And we want to see more of that. As Dan said, you know, we haven't been seeing much of them. We've just been seeing bits and pieces. Here's their episode. Here's their spotlight episode. And it's one of those things like, you know, there's no room for it, of course. But you're like, you know, I could watch a miniseries of these guys. You're like two or three or four episodes, right? You could see something like that. This episode had a bit of Ocean's 11, a bit of Doctor Who thrown into it. So, you know, and as you said, it's one of the better episodes ever. So you could tell where the score is going to go.
Well, wait for it. Vicky, since you're an avowed fan of all the shows that we talk about here, what are your feelings on the Dark, Merlin, et cetera, on this one?
It was gold. These three are just gold when they're working, interacting together like this. You know, like they're saying with Merlin and Dark bickering, and then they just pull out and just literally start fighting each other was fantastic. And then, oh, it had to be Rip that had to be the one. Oh no, don't you think that Thawne was playing you guys and getting you to do this? was pretty amusing. And so yeah, I could, like they were saying, I could watch, you know, these guys just interact for quite a while before I'd get sick of it.
Right. Something Dan mentioned from the outset occurs to me here, because Dan, you had mentioned that one of the things you were enjoying throughout the season is that they were just, you know, sprinkling in, you know, the Dark then and Thawne and then now and then Merlin after, and not, you know, overplaying their hand there.
But then not using it as a crutch or anything.
But then you got this episode, which one can say maybe they built to this because there was a certain amount of mystery and, you know, wondering why they're doing what they're doing or how they're doing what they're doing. So maybe we ended up with a better payoff here by doing it that way. Is that how you saw it? Or...
Yeah, this is perfectly placed. It doesn't feel just like, oh, we don't know what to do. You know, the actors need a break. Let's have these guys carry an episode, you know, and do whatever. They just like, you know, progress naturally. And the placement was really, really solid.
Right. I think another thing with them is speaking just, you know, from a writing perspective, especially Merlin and Dark, they're fun characters to write for. Because there's a lot of snark. There's a gleefully evil or, you know, snideness to both those characters. So in a way, you kind of if you would overuse them in previous episodes, I think they really would have overshadowed the legends far too much. So it was better maybe to build up to here because this episode was supposed to be more about them than anything else. So it made sense to focus on them, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it was good that, you know, we did have an episode that was more light on the legends and then heavier on the Legion.
Right. We should mention, because I didn't mention it in the recap because I just didn't bother. For people who are paying close attention when this episode aired, if you're watching, when they go to the opening logo of Legends of Tomorrow... and if you happen to have it in your DVRs, people, go back and check this out, or go check it on the CW or whatever, slow-mo it, you'll see that when the logo is coming up, it's composed of initially the separate emblems or logos for each of these villains. So it's almost like the Legion of Doom is taking over the logo for Legends of Tomorrow. You'll see symbols that represent both Dark... which is a weird one, Merlin, and of course the most obvious one for the Reverse Flash. So I became aware of that through something I read online, and then I went back and watched it, and I was like, oh, look at that! That's so cool.
Well, for Merlin, isn't it like the logo of the Legion of Assassins?
Yes, I just couldn't remember what the Dark one was.
Dark ones, yeah, it's weird. Was that the Hive logo?
That's what I figured.
That must be what it is. Yeah, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Because that's the only thing I can think they could even attach to him.
I also like that in this situation, because of our experience with Merlin over the last 5 years on Arrow, but here, he's the rational one. You know?
Yeah.
he's the one who thinks maybe we shouldn't kill everybody. <You know? laughs> where Dark is just like, well, I don't understand why we don't just kill everybody. Like, no, we don't have to. It's like, well, I like that. Wait, Malcolm's got a conscience? You know, considering what he's done on Arrow, that's just great. I just love that. Okay, I'm sure, you know what, even though we're going to move on to other topics, I got a feeling we're going to keep, they're going to pop up from time to time during our conversation because they're just so much fun to talk about. But let's talk about Martin Stein and the situation with his daughter. Not to mention, you know, the rest of the team working on the general mystery of who the speedster is, which up until this episode I was kind of questioning, but I'll give them credit. It made sense that they wouldn't know who it was until the point where they did figure it out. But as far as the Martin Stein stuff, I was thinking about something that was said in a podcast several weeks ago, months ago now, and I believe Dan was the one who had said it, who one of the things he was looking forward to, or potentially looking forward to, was maybe an episode that had a lot of focus on Martin Stein and Victor Garber specifically, and about dealing with this situation and the ramifications of it. And although I think we might have thought we got it to a certain extent in previous episodes, this was really the episode for that. I want to lead off with Dan on this one to see how he felt about how Garber did and how that storyline played out throughout the episode.
Oh yeah, I thought Garber was great. This is kind of like what I was expecting for like the progression of the storyline. I still think at some point there'll be some kind of episode where like he has to make a choice whether or not she you know, he has to do something and this like letter not exist anymore for some reason or something. And
yeah.
maybe something like that will happen. I mean, I'm not sure at this point if they'll do something like that. Or, you know, I don't want him to, I don't want him to change Diggle's son to a daughter again by doing some kind of tomfoolery, but yeah, it was nice to see. And it was a good episode to, fit it in, even though, you know, I wasn't expecting them to go to Central City to grab her. I thought maybe they'd ask Cisco a question or something, but it you know, at least we got to see CC Jitters this week.
Right, and that would be our next. We had a location crossover, so we're back in Central City. We're at CC Jitters. We don't run into anyone of the Flash cast, however, but we also in like in the previous segment, we do get enough clips and connections to the Flash, so it felt like we were crossing over a lot to the Flash. By the way,
I didn't half-ass any of that.
No. Oh, I regret that I didn't. I deliberately didn't mention it in the recap because I wanted to give it all to Kay to talk about. But now I'm gonna skip back and say it. Oh my God, the Black Flash stuff was so amazingly cool.
Like, oh my gosh, yes, it was.
Genuinely, you know how much I like the way they did the Black Flash here? It made me think of when Zoom first appeared and we thought, oh, that's one scary motherfucker. I'm going to curse now. Scary motherfucker. And then he turned out to not be so much. It's like, oh, now he's become a horrifying thing.
Right, it took a whole season, a different show. I finally got what I wanted.
Yeah.
But...
I will take it as acceptable that I had to suffer through Zoom that I Black Flash. I will take it. That is worth it.
What I loved about it is that it was legitimately a horrifying vision. It was really something kind of like creepy, scary as hell, and much, much better than the quote unquote time rates, which, you know, just smack a little bit too much of Harry Potter and whatever, as far as I'm concerned. But this was. The fact that Eobard Thawne was as terrified as he was makes perfect sense when you see what it was he was literally on the run from. So I love that explanation and how that ties in and how something that happens in season one directly of The Flash directly ties into something that happens in season two of The Flash and then pays off in season two of Legends of Tomorrow. It's a great thing about watching the show, having watched the other shows, that, you know, it finally is working the way we wanted it to, and it didn't in season one, I think.
And it's super cool.
One of the best things, that, I think.
No, Dan.
Fuck you, Cade. You didn't show up last week.
Go. I stopped to let you talk. Shut up. Just go.
No, you shut up. Stop laughing, Jason.
Yeah, Jason. Don't. We'll turn on you. Stop it.
I like how they set up the Black Flash and made him look cool, but then just kind of like let the storyline simmer a little bit. So at some point in the future, you know, he'll show up again and, I don't know, kill Thawne or something. But just the fact that he's like still out there and show up at other times, it kind of like just makes it. I'm looking forward to when that happens.
I'm going to counter that. I'm going to say that the villains win and they stop the Black Flash.
Boo.
And Thawne, and Thawne becomes, you know, he becomes back into reality again.
And I want him to lose because I don't like his costume. That lightning bolt should be yellow or something.
I do want to talk about Black Flash. The inhumanity of what they put on that to made him into is what works so good for him. He doesn't move like a human. The way he gets near Thawne and breathes, it's like he's a hunting dog smelling for things. His movements are disjointed. It just looks so unnatural, but it works perfectly through what he is now. There is no trace of any living being like a person in that anymore. That is just darkness hunting things down.
There was something I thought was very interesting. I like that you touched on that. Not so much the whole not sensing he was there because he wasn't moving, because that's a concept and idea we've seen before and other things, which is fine. But it was the movement. There are certain points where he moves. I was trying to figure out how they were doing it. Whether it was the skill of the actor, or they were playing some photographic effects with us here.
Yeah.
I didn't know if there was any. I don't know if there was any sort of additional animation done with some of those things. I mean, beyond obviously when he's whizzing around, that's obvious. But it was the fact that it was just done to just a slight degree to make it slightly more unsettling. I thought made it work really well. So And it put us in a very weird position because it was like, oh, am I kind of rooting for Eobard Thawne to be okay right now? I mean, other than the fact that I really like the Reverse Flash, but this is, when they were like face to face there, I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. I just wish we could just have, someone could just bring up a picture of Teddy Sears and have them all like freak out or something. It's like, no.
It was kind of neat that like Malcolm was like cool and smart enough to figure out like how to handle the situation, while Thawne was just like, you know, completely freaked out by his boogeyman.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen Malcolm be like smart and like plan well, but it seems like it's kind of been a while. He was kind of a schlub last season on Arrow, I think. So
yes,
it's kind of nice to see him like, you know, using his talents.
He's clearly the brains of this trio.
He was reduced to just showing up at the Arrow cave and making a comment and leaving.
He went from being the next Ra's al Ghul to being the next lackey on Arrow.
I mean, look at how they find him. He's basically Quentin Lansing the situation. I'm just going to drink in this sad apartment.
Oh,
to fall away.
That opening was so good to just to bring everything together and just right off the bat they. See, to me, this show may be one of the best written episodes I've seen of this show or any of the CW shows, because they were able to concisely explain a situation with a very short scene. That's something these shows don't usually pull off very well, unless there's like some ridiculous amount of blah-bitty-blah exposition involved.
Here it is
done really almost shockingly well. And I know we've been really pro this show this season, and I agree with that, but this episode I thought was just exceptional in how they handled not just the fun dialogue, but they really reasoned out how these characters, what their motivations were and how they acted with each other. They did such a good job with that. I mean, there is one little nitpick I have, but I almost don't want to bring it up because it's probably just me being nitpicky and I try not to. I'm going to do it anyway. Okay. Here's a question I have for you guys. So, Eobard Thawne, Reverse Flash, one of his things he does that we've seen is he's always threatening people, usually here Malcolm, that he's going to, you know, vibrate his hand and phase through him and, you know, kill him, right? So we know that much like Barry, he knows and has the ability to pass through objects, to vibrate his body at a certain speed where he can pass through something. Which is an emblematic of all speedsters. They always have had that power in the comics, and they've been using that on the show as well. And he's been doing this for a really long time, so he's probably known how to do that for years and years and years. So, can someone explain to me why Eobard Thawne would not be able to phase out of a locked vault? Because I couldn't figure out why he couldn't just vibrate his way out of there. I know the writers just wanted to ignore that because they wanted to it would screw up the plot of this episode, so I went along with it. But in my mind, I kept thinking he should be able to get out of there. There's no reason why he can't. Did I miss something? Because I don't think I did.
I was wondering the exact same thing.
I presume that the vault was like made of like whatever, you know, some element that was in the cages that Zoom had. Barry and, I don't know, I can't even remember who was in the fucking mask anymore.
Right.
The real Jay Garrick.
The real Jay Garrick.
Let's try to not to remember that crap. That's a lovely explanation, but I don't really buy it. I don't know if this bank in Switzerland in 2025 would know to have this material, which I don't even know if that material even exists on Earth 1 to begin with, since that was on Earth 2, I think that was happening, right? Wasn't that on Earth 2?
I
don't know.
I have a theory.
Oh, boy. I love
kids. Since he knew the Black... His watch went off, he knew Black Flash was close. You can assume to do the phasing through the wall uses far more power than just running fast. It's possible he thought maybe he would detect him quicker and get his location sooner if he did something that used that much power, so he stopped himself from doing it.
That makes sense.
All right. I'm willing to buy that one.
Speed Force knowledge right here.
Oh, shut the fuck up. you totally ruined it with that.
Dan, cut that part out, please.
I will. I'll do that when I add in the cats fighting audio to when you and me were fake arguing a few minutes ago.
Cool. Good.
I do want to mention, I like I said, I really like them trying to figure out that he was a Eobard Thawne, and the fact that, as we said in a previous podcast, once it came down to it, it was going to be Martin Stein who would make the connection and say Eobard Thawne, because he's the one who had the previous experience with him, which then helped build on the whole, how the heck is he even doing all this? So many things about this episode really came together well. And that was one more thing, which I know became like the plot C of the episode, despite how important it really was. But I thought they handled that exceedingly well as well.
Yeah, it was nice. All these little things we were wondering about that they just kind of, tied a loop around. Vicky?
Yeah, thanks. No, I was going to say I liked that too, because I was wondering why Stein hadn't quite made the connection, but then they had, a very good explanation for that, because since he had been erased from, time or whatever, when Eddie killed himself.
Right.
Then, yeah.
Right. All right. Is there anything else you guys want to say about this really good episode before we get to the grading section? I mean, I have like one silly thing I want to say about the previous week's episode I just remembered, but I figured I'd let you guys talk first if you have anything.
I want to talk about something for the season in general real quick.
Oh, okay.
What's the deal with Mick? What? Like, Mick in last season was one of the character I really liked. I didn't mind seeing on the screen. His story was interesting. He had really come around. And now he's almost reverted back to the first Mick, like early season one Mick again. Like, all that progress he made at the end of season one is just gone. He's just being a buffoon and oafish all the time now. What? I want to know why they're doing that.
Yeah, it's getting very kind of grating and tired.
That's my only like drawback for the season, is how Mick is seemingly being handled and what they're planning to do, whatever they're doing with him.
Hmm. Dan, do you want to counter any of that?
No, I've enjoyed what they're doing. I don't think they've make him seem like he's a complete dumbass. He tends to be, tactically intelligent, and has a decent grasp of like the way the other characters are relating to each other. I mean, sometimes he'll do just a bonehead move like this, but that wasn't like to the detriment of the show or my enjoyment of the character. It's just like, oh, of course he's gonna be tactless and just say this and then continue to be tactless.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of fun, and I still think he's he's the team can count on him, and he's kind of an asshole.
Yeah,
but I still think the characters hasn't regressed for me.
Go on, Vix.
No, I was just gonna say this was kind of a Julian level of not sensing the just not interpersonal skills.
Well, you know what? I'm going to differ from you slightly on this, and I'm gonna side with Dan on this issue. I think what we're confusing here, and it's exactly what Dan kind of said actually. I don't think he's regressed intelligence wise. I think he still has the whole "I've gotten smarter after what the Time Master did to me." He's never been Mr. Personality, and the difference between say him and say like Julian you just mentioned. Julian is tactless. But then once it's brought to his attention, he'll feel bad about it. He just doesn't.
Yeah.
Mick doesn't care. That's not.
Yeah, Mick's like CJ.
Really? Do we have no? Anyway, that should be cut out. Or to be more crass, because this is a time where cursing is appropriate. Mick just don't give a fuck. He just don't. It would be inconsistent for his character if in this instance he did. He should only have certain moments where it's like saving a life where he does. But here, I don't think so. So the fact that he doesn't care that he, oops, let it slip about the professor's daughter is totally in line with his character. The fact that he was the one character they all thought would be the one to blow it, and voila, he does, pretty much makes perfect sense. I enjoy the fact he was calling everybody idiots, quite frankly, because that's something he wouldn't have done early season one because, well, he was an idiot, So I actually am enjoying what they've done with him. I think the stuff with him and Professor Stein in a previous episode was a lot of fun as well. And, you know, to a certain degree, he does supply a bit of the comic relief on the show. And that's what his use has been more often than not. And that, for me, pretty much has worked certainly more than a lot of other attempts at humor that sometimes might fall flat with the show. So I'm enjoying it, I would say. So there. Hey, really quickly, I want to mention something from last week, which led to the title of this episode, actually. Last week's episode, which we one thing we didn't mention was the fact that Nate is the one who coins the term the Legion of Doom, and he actually makes a little side, you know, almost under his breath, but a reference to the fact he got the idea from a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. Now, I know that the writers thought they were being really funny and really cute and winking at the Super Friends cartoon, which is what he's talking about. And I know many people probably enjoyed that. And the fact that it plays throughout that episode, yada, 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 who cares? There's one problem with doing that, for me personally. There's a certain logic issue which happens if Nate had seen the Super Friends cartoon back in the 70s. You know, the cartoon when they're fighting the Legion of Doom, which means it's Superman and Batman and, you know, the Flash and all these other characters. There couldn't have been a cartoon about those characters back in the 70s. Yeah. So, I know they played it safe by just saying a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. I know that. But I was like, you know, I don't know if we needed that reference. They've dropped enough little Super Friends references on the show already and have gotten away with it, like even using the term Super Friends or the whole Hall of Justice thing that we saw in that other episode. This, I don't think we needed to literally mention the Hanna-Barbera cartoon myself. If anyone disagrees, feel free.
I don't.
Yeah.
It's a little too on the nose. It's a little too meta. It's like, that's a bit much.
I just thought they just went one step too far with that. Again, it didn't bother me. I just went, you know. It wouldn't have affected my grade for the episode or something like that. It's just like when a line might fall flat or something. I just like, you know, like some of the George Lucas stuff, most of it was well done. But there was a couple of parts where like, a little forced. That's it. There's something a bit forced or contrived about it, which I could have done with that, I think.
Yeah, it was cute, though, how Sarah refuses to call him that.
Yeah, that works. That's fine. I love the fact that she doesn't like that. You know, she's still, like, the mom of the group so far on the show.
I like someone who's from the League of Assassins, hates the name the Legion of Doom.
That's a brilliant observation. I didn't even think of that. Nicely done. Didn't even think of that. Because that's just stupid. Okay, other than the fact that, hey, I think the guy, what's his name, Vicky, the actor who plays Rip Hunter, since he's from Doctor Who.
Arthur Darvill.
I think he's more fun to watch him as Phil and what he did in this episode than he's ever been as Rip on this show. It's almost too bad that he's going to be Rip again, although it looks like he might be kind of fun in the upcoming episode, but I thought he did a really good job in this episode.
Oh yeah, he's doing a great job.
Okay. He's just going to show how he's not being used well as Rip. Like they haven't given him enough to do as Rip Hunter. He's just being the sourpuss dad figure.
Yeah, hopefully if they like have him back on the team, it'll be used better.
Yeah, that. I mean, it's funny how we've talked several times about how the show has improved due to the lack of Hawks and lack of Savage, but it might also be because of the lack of Rip Hunter in a lot of ways. Although we didn't hate him the way we hated those other characters, except for Vicky, who loved them all. But again, and we said it last week, so I don't want to talk that much about it here, but it's been nice not to have that repetitive, you know, episode after episode Rip Hunter riff that became kind of tiresome after a while. So it'll be interesting to see how that character evolves and develops after going through what he's going through now. So And I hope that's a character I hope doesn't revert, to use what Cade was saying when he thought Heatwave was kind of moving back. No one ever calls him Heatwave, of course. Anyway. Can we safely say it's time to get to the scorecards now?
I have one little thing I'd like to add.
Sure, sure.
For the first time this season, the voiceover intro to Legends of Tomorrow wasn't unbearable. It was actually enjoyable to hear.
That was so cool.
Oh, you went so mean. It was. You're right. That should have been mentioned. Damian Dark doing the intro was brilliant. A bit much to say, but it was for this show kind of brilliant.
It was not blasé.
I almost wish they could have the villains do one intro every season, but. Oh, wait, then we would have gotten Vandal set. Oh, no. Forget I said that. Oh, that would have been horrible. Yes, I also loved him doing the opening. They should have the villains do the openings on all the shows, quite frankly. Okay. So, we're going to get to the scores now, but there's something I want to say before we get to Vicky's grade here. Kind of a new thing I want to do now, because for most of the episodes that we watch, of these four series that we talk about, they range anywhere from fair to good, and we've run the gamut with our grades, 2.5 to 5, whatever, It occurs to me that once in a very, very rare while, something else might be needed, because what happens when something is given a 5, which we've all done a couple times now, and in fact, all of us gave last week's Legends of Tomorrow episode a 5, but what happens when any of us feel that an episode really, truly surpasses that one? So, taking a cue from countless reality competition shows and things of that nature, I've decided that each of us here should also have what I would say like 2 extra guns in your arsenal. So, for the rest of this CW season, and this applies to all 4 shows, each of us will have 2 special high grades at our disposal. We'll each get, whatever you want to call it. We each get like 2 silver 6s. I know it should be golden, but I like alliteration, so we can say silver. So what I'm saying is each of us now has an opportunity, or 2 opportunities, between now and, middle of May, when all these shows are over at that point. If we want to give an episode a 6... if we feel it's at that out of time or better level of greatness, we can do that. I also just like the idea of there being just one more potential surprise at our disposal when we're giving grades here, because now that fives has become, I don't want to say commonplace, but we've doled them out a few times. So I just want there to be just that one little bit special thing, more so when we're doing the grades. So hopefully everyone's okay with that. If none of you want to use it, that's fine. You don't have to do it. But if I want it to be there, if there's an episode that really stands out to that extent for any of you. All right?
I'm going to predict Vicky gives this a 6 and the Arrow episode from last night a 6.
Seems to be a bit of 7. So, Vicky, let's see if Dan is psychic. What was your grade for this episode of Legends of Tomorrow?
I'm going to give it a 4.5.
not what I was expecting. Oh, it's because it focused on bad guys. That's...
No.
Lies. Liar. Liar. Lies. 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 All right, then. Wow, that was not expecting that. I don't know how to move on. Cade.
This is getting my first silver 6.
There you go.
There's no doubt about it. As I told you earlier, it is easily, if it's easily the best episode of Legends we've had, if not one of, not the best CW superhero series episode we've had. Hands down, this is getting the silver 6, the first one.
Jason?
What did you compare them to? Bullets? Is that what you said? The sixes?
Whatever you want to cut, it's whatever analysis you want to come up
with. Well, then bang, it gets a 6. there's no doubt. There's no doubt this deserves a 6. Vicky, I don't know what's going on.
Okay,
my jaw
okay,
is on
you know
my
what?
Jaw is no, you yeah. can't change it now. It's too late.
Don't change because he's passing. You,
no, no, no.
What you said.
It's peer pressure, huh?
Swearing. This is a PG podcast.
Oh my god. Dan, remember you have to keep bleeping Vicky now. Vicky, jeez. Yeah. Wow. My ears.
Whoa.
I mean, if this gets a 6, nothing else should get a 6 ever.
Okay. You know what?
Don't respond to peer pressure.
Don't give in.
No, don't give in. Just
you had your opinion. Don't let Jason force you to change your opinion.
Just getting peer pressure against peer pressure. That's weird.
Vicky, I'm okay, giving it a 4.5, so shut up.
Okay, you know what? No, I was being a little bit picky. I did highly enjoy it, so I'm gonna give it another 5.
Ah, you freak. Well, I'm giving it a 4.5. I didn't enjoy it quite as much as I did last week's episode, so it was a really good episode, but it doesn't quite get there for me like last week's. So 4.5. Thanks, Vicky. Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.
I thought this one was so much better than last week's. I almost want to go back and lower my grade for last week's episode because of how much more lameness there was throughout that episode compared to this one. And yes, I'm only saying this because Dan said that. No, I'm just kidding. I am obviously giving this my 6 as well because why else would I have fucking come up with a stupid grade system anyway?
Exactly. I mean, why else?
Wouldn't it have been awesome if I
this
didn't?
Episode.
Wouldn't it be great if I
like
didn't
I gave
give
it
a
5
six?
And a half.
I'm giving it a 5. A 5 1/3. But what Cade said is exactly what my thoughts were. It's for me, it's the best episode I've seen of this series. It's the best written episode, the way they tied everything together. They're unlike, say, last week's episode. There were no characters or performances I thought were weak, like George Lucas. And we got a great payoff for what the season has been building up to for the last, 11, 12 episodes, which is also something we don't really get too often on this show. So, yeah, it's I want to give it a 7 now. No, it's a 6. Okay, I knew that was going to be the episode that we were going to spend a lot of time on, so anyone who's checking their watches will notice that we got through Supergirl and Flash really in record time, just so we could spend a whole lot of time on that episode of Legends. So, with that said, I'm anticipating a quicker pass when we talk about Arrow, Second Chances. So let's get to that 2-minute recap of Arrow. We came into this episode figuring we were going to meet the new Black Canary. And in fact, maybe we did, but what we really got was an episode that kind of stuck the landing pretty well in terms of, sticking to the overall theme, which is right there in the title, Second Chances. Because Ollie and his recruits, except for Ragman, who I guess due to budgetary concerns, because they had to spend all the VFX money on the other two metahumans in this week, they head down to the excitingly named Hub City to track down Tina Bond in hopes of persuading her to take on the mantle of the Black Canary. So right there, you've got layer upon layer of second chances, because the new team of recruits, they've always represented a second chance for Team Arrow, as the old team of Roy, Thea, and then later Laurel had fallen apart. So each member of this team, as the not annoying for at least one scene for a change Renee points out, is themselves getting a second chance as well. And then you have Ollie viewing recruiting a new Black Canary is his own second chance at redemption for Laurel's death, even if I don't think he really had much to do with that. And if Tina Bond should accept his offer, it becomes a second chance for her at a new life as well. So, whatever. The story plays out in Hub City as one would expect. Initial distrust, rejection, maybe some fighting, a reluctant alliance in the face of an unexpected threat. Here being the man that Tina was obsessed with finding turns out to be a metahuman just like herself. And by the end of the episode, it looks like we are going to get a new team member. Meanwhile, back in Star City, Felicity returns to her hacktivism days of yore in order to find information that the NSA has on the military ass munch who's got Diggle and a vice there. She meets a fellow dark web person who basically is Felicity from 5 or 10 years ago. She gets the MacGuffin that will help free John from prison on bail and most likely help get all the charges dropped. But what's really at play here is that this awakens a side of Felicity that she had buried pretty much. So maybe she's getting, wait for it, a second chance to do and be more than just Overwatch and the voice in the ears of a team of vigilantes. And of course, this result also results in Diggle, as I said, getting released from prison, which means he too is getting a second chance. So there's your present day storyline for the episode, but we can't move on without mentioning the flashback story, which in many ways may be, it could be considered the most important flashback that we've seen in this series. And I'm sure we're going to talk about it a bit more a little later, because in this flashback we see how Talia, and yes, that's Talia al Ghul, who I like to think of as the farmer's daughter to Batman's traveling salesman, she's instrumental in guiding Oliver, but I'm so proud of that analogy, I should just end the podcast now. Even though only comic book fans will get it, but I don't care. She proves to be instrumental in guiding Oliver to becoming the vigilante hero we would see showing up in Starling City some months after that flashback. Okay, I'm tired. That's enough recapping. Let's move on to you guys and this discussion. So let's start off right with topic number one, where, you know, what happens in Hub City doesn't necessarily stay there because Ollie, Renee, and Curtis try to recruit that new Black Canary. Let's talk about how that pans out here. Dan, let's start with you for a change. How did you think that went in this episode?
I thought it was... I enjoyed the way that they've done it. I mean, we've already seen some recruitment type stuff happen earlier in the season, but this didn't feel redundant at all. And it was really cool the way they set it up. I mean, it's been like a long time since we've seen like a good, particle accelerator spamming, which is like, it just feels like a really long time since I've seen one of these that actually like worked out. And it was, you know, smart too. Having a
Mary
type abilities. Yeah, I mean, they shot well, they made it look cool, and it just...
Yeah, did you really... Not really, I mean, obviously. Did you really enjoy the way they did that effect with the Sonus character? That weird, almost a Vertigo-like effect, so to speak, which has nothing to do with Count Vertigo because he's a different villain entirely. But I really liked the way that looked. That was kind of a nice effect, which we don't usually see on this show very often. So I thought that was really...
Yeah, nice. That was neat. It was definitely different, though.
just to fill in the 5 seconds of geekiness, that character is actually based on an actual comic book villain who appeared briefly in the comics. I had to look this up because I wasn't familiar with him. Because when his name was Sonus, I thought, is this a weird version of Sonar? No, he's actually a villain named Discord, who's fights Green Arrow and Black Canary. Same character's name, somewhat similar abilities, hence the name Discord. So they didn't create him for the show. They didn't just create him out of thin air. He actually is from the comics, believe it or not. Although I don't think he's had hardly that many appearances, quite frankly.
He won't have very many after this one.
Right. Can I say I love that she shot him, by the way? Because I love when he says, "What would what's his face want you to do?" And I was like, "Yeah, she'd want me to. He killed me. He'd want you to kill him. Of course, it makes perfect sense." Kay, what did you think of the potential new Black Canary and the way the storyline played out?
I like the new Black Canary story. I like the new Black Canary. What we've seen of her so far, I like how there was not just that she's been roaming the country, tracking down a crime ring on her own, doing everything. So when Oliver shows up, like, we're used to seeing people attached to him wanting to be part of his thing, or she's like, I've been doing this by myself. I don't need you people. You're not here to help me. And just turning him down at every chance because it took her a while to realize maybe she does need him, which is different than every other person who's ever attached themselves to the team where they felt they needed something Oliver could give them, where she's different, which gave us a storyline we hadn't seen before, where he kept chasing her, trying, let us help you, let us help you. And even when she does let him help you, she's still going to be herself. She still has that edge to her, which they'll probably round off. But the fact she killed him, it's like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I know who you are. It's not like you can judge me for killing someone.
Yeah.
The word's been out about who you are. I know this. Don't come at me with that. That was the really good part about her character, and I hope that kind of stays. I like her character having some ability to back up to Oliver, to fight back, to say, hey, no, it's not going to be that way, because he can just take command of everybody and they'll do what he says. It's good to have someone who isn't trying to fight back. Like, I know what I'm doing. This is someone who's been doing it for 3 years. She's not just some like street level vigilante in Star City. She's fought clearly a crime ring on her own this entire time. Hmm. She's capable of doing more than just being, hey, here's a sidekick for yourself. She really could become Black Canary, who side by side as Oliver, as an equal, not as someone who's a follower of him.
Right, that makes sense. Vicky, what was your take on her?
I thought she was really cool. I agree with a lot of what Kate said. I like the fact that she could basically be an equal to Oliver on this team, where, you know, a lot of the time we just see the other people who are the part of the team are his quote unquote, you know, subordinates, and he just kind of bosses them around and whatnot. So it'll be interesting to see that dynamic develop as they try to, you know, work together and what. And the fight scenes were pretty great. On the rooftop at the end, that was pretty cool. Yeah. When, you know, Oliver shot the one arrow into the helicopter that was basically swinging around using that as leverage to fight.
Yeah, I'll confess I've become really negative about a lot of the fight scenes on this show because I found them kind of, I didn't really like the way they've been shot quite often. Maybe it's usually because they're always in the same stupid settings, quite frankly. This is one of the few times I really enjoyed the way an entire fight scene played out. The stuff with the helicopter, him swinging around and shooting stuff. I love focusing on the different kind of arrows he was shooting also. I always say, the more Green Arrow uses his actual bow and arrow, which is what he should be doing, the more I'll enjoy it. When it's just, I don't like Green Arrow, fighting someone when they're actually like using their bow to hit people. That strikes me as stupid. It has never made sense to me. I think ask any archer, they'll be like, I would never use my bow for that because what if you break it? What if you bend it? What if something happens to it? It's not a sword. It doesn't make any sense. But I really did enjoy the way the fight scene played out on that rooftop. So, you know.
Yeah. I also will say, I think this week with these little kind of micro crossovers, they showed how it's possible to, you know, interconnect all these shows without having to do these big, these big multi-episode events like they did with, you know, Vandal Savage last season, and then also then with the hero, you know, the Heroes versus Aliens this season. Yeah.
I think this episode would qualify as the quickest or briefest superhero cameo of any crossover that they've ever done. And I think I read somewhere well beforehand that one of the people behind the show, not Berlanti, it might have been Andrew Kreisberg or someone like that, made a comment like that in the press. Like, it will be the fastest the quickest crossover ever.
Yep, he did.
And again, not just so much that we got the blur of the Flash running through, but much like we saw, a side character like Miss Tessmacher from Supergirl in the episode of The Flash. Here we got Captain. Is it Singh? Is that how we pronounce his
name?
Singh.
Yes. Yeah.
Who he actually probably got a bit more screen time in this few moments here than he seems to ever get on The Flash, quite frankly. But I very much enjoyed that. Barry basically leaving a post-it to confirm. Yeah. Although, you know, part of me was like, hey, it's too bad Quentin Lance is in, you know, rehab, because maybe one of the cops from Star City could have vouched for Ollie, but whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, I had that thought too.
Right. Jason, was there anything you wanted to say here before we move on?
I thought it was nice that they took the show on the road to a different city and hung out there for a little bit. Hub City. As if it's, you know, it's a the known comics location for the DC universe.
Is it, would you say it's at the center of the DC universe?
Yeah, sure. Because Why not? It's a hub.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a hub.
And this is how we move on to the next topic. All right, so might not be much to say here, but hey, you know, Felicity, maybe this could be a possible re-energizing of that character who I think some people out there have had some issues with, and I kind of understand why. And hey, have we finally dropped the Diggle in prison storyline? Finally, can he actually be involved in what's going on the show now? So, Vicky, did you have any thoughts on these two things?
Yeah, I enjoyed what Felicity had to do this episode. And like you're saying, I think hopefully that this would maybe give her something else to do than just kind of being, you know, support for the for Team Arrow, and this other hacker basically nudging her back into what she used to do could be good for the character.
I would agree with you on that. I think it gives her more dimension, more to do than what she's been designated to, or what's the word I'm looking for? Resigned to on the ship? Whatever.
Yeah.
It's late.
Because really, since she got fired from Palmer Tech, she hasn't done a whole lot outside of Team Arrow stuff. So.
Exactly. And in an odd way, it's almost timely to have someone decide that they want to be more active or be more hacktive out there. Because that's certainly, we could use a little bit of that right now. More, not just the WikiLeaks kind of crap. Hey, can we move on to the next and last topic for this one here? Why am I asking? I'm going to do it anyway. I'm just going to do it. So let's get to those flashbacks with Talia. And the flashbacks are really, you know, it's how it really all begins. So we're finally getting to that. So, Jason, you've watched the show from the get-go. You've also, you know, Talia from the comics, and we're not going to include Dark Knight Rises because that's lame. What did you think of this specific flashback this week?
I liked it. It was good to see Ollie put on the hood, finally. We finally get to that point where he dons it from the first episode. So that was good. I'm still not a huge fan of the flashbacks, but I guess you have to tie it all together and end it eventually, hopefully soon. You could tell I loved it.
Yeah. All right. So your reaction is more of a begrudging, like, all right, whatever.
We're just doing it by the numbers is what we're doing right now.
Okay. Disagree. Okay.
So wrong.
Thank you.
Like, you can clearly take this season's flashbacks, and this one especially, in this episode, where it's very much concentrated in two locations. It's not jumping around. In the early part, the Talia Ollie flashback continues from where it left off when it goes back to it. And it has so much being entertained. You get a lot about her. You get the slip to realize how old she is. This is when Oliver's like, you're half his age. You get that bit. So you find out about her, but you also find out about Oliver. You get that motivational push that none of the other flashbacks give us. They never gave us anything that's like, this is how Ollie got this skill. It's like, who cares? This is how Ollie was given the drive or the insight to go on the mission that he went on. It directly relates to the season we're in because we're seeing repercussions of it. And you get to see, like, the comment about, she's going into this fight with a bow and arrow, and and she just goes, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And you get to see, okay, that clearly influences him because he realizes you can take a bow and arrow, you can go into those situations. Now, he's as lethal as it comes with a gun, apparently, because he killed like 40 people with that gun. Just shit everybody. It was a giant. It really, like Scott, you mentioned, it really felt like one of the scenes from John Wick and how it was choreographed. That might be one of the best choreographed scenes I've seen on this show and how they used it. There was no wasted effort. There's no like spinny kicks. It's a lot of moving from here to there to shoot and to take people down.
It was a great scene. It was beautifully insane.
It really was.
It's possibly one of my favorite action sequences I've seen on this show because it got to a point where it was just so over the top, ridiculous. I loved it. It's like, I actually wanted to go back and count how many people he had killed.
Oh, yeah.
Good Lord. He's killing it. I always liken it to that moment in the movie The Departed where so many people are killed in this one scene. It becomes comical. Like, you know, the bodies feel like they're actually piling up on one another. That's the way this scene plays out. And then and the fact that it builds up to him getting into that the car or the limousine, whatever, for that guy. And initially it looks like he's just going to, you know, beat him up a bit. And then you realize, oh, wait. So after he just shot, like you said, like seemingly like 40 guys, he then beats a guy to death.
Yeah. He just beats him to death with his pistol because his face has the blood splatter from the hits. I'm like,
it was good.
It was just good. There's no other way. You don't have to use any other word to describe it. It was just good. And those things right there immediately make the flashbacks in this episode and the past ones better than anything we've gotten in two seasons.
Oh, yeah.
There is something in the flashbacks. Like, it's not like to tell a story. It's like you get something out of that flashback besides the story. You got a scene that was entertaining, which is what last season's flashbacks never even approached entertaining. Well, it was like a bad history class from the 60s.
Did you notice there's a great moment in the flashback? And I would say, again, if anyone still has it in their DVR, you should go back and just listen to this one piece of dialogue. There's a moment in the flashback where I believe the writers, through Talia, actually go out of their way to mock how they've handled the flashbacks for the last couple seasons. It seems to actually point out the scattered, almost nonsense of the last couple years of what the flashbacks on this show. And which is why I think one of the reasons we've been enjoying the flashbacks more so this season, other than obviously the Dolph Lundgren factor, has been there's an end game finally, and there's a sharper focus to it. Has every flashback been great? No, we've probably actually been a little bit nicer on occasion than maybe we should have been. But I think we got a lot of payoff to them with this specific one, because this is finally the one that really feels like it brings shit together. The outfit, the bow and arrow, the book of his father, the fact that it really makes a lot of sense in a weird way that the people, you know, Talia al Ghul, i.e. Ra's al Ghul's daughter, would be someone who motivate him to do what he ends up going to Starling City to do. Because if you think about what his mission was, that's kind of in line with the kind of thinking that Ra's al Ghul would have to a certain extent. So there's a logic that I was almost shocked to see on this show, quite frankly, especially in a flashback. So I was really a fan of it. And the fact that she's playing an almost iconic comic book character, you know, maybe a touch under being iconic. And I thought she was fine. I mean, you know, much like I thought the guy who played Ra's al Ghul was fine. I only wish we could have a scene with those two together, but they probably can't bring that actor back. I don't know. But I really enjoy the flashback a lot myself.
I thought it was kind of cool how they the way they edited it they placed a little emphasis on the fact that like she had his father's book in her possession for a little bit, since you know we're all kind of wondering what the deal with Prometheus is. So I think this adds like one more layer of like possibility to that as you know, another character.
Oh yeah, we're definitely
had access to it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you said that because I didn't even think of that. Fact
at this point we have lots of options. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're just building on what you're saying. The fact that that aspect of this really, for me, and I think for all of us maybe, has more connection to what's going on with this Prometheus situation. I think far more than the whole, oh, you're the son of like the first guy he killed or whatever the hell that
definitely
thing was. I'm fascinated to see who may actually be behind the mask in this. I keep thinking of other possibilities, and one genuinely or literally just occurred to me, and it's so stupid that it couldn't possibly be it, but it would be so crazy awesome if it was. Although wait, they killed him. I guess it can't be him. Is there any way there could be an Al Ghul as Prometheus? Is it possible?
It's not. I mean, Nissa al Ghul popped up, not really a known character. They used her before. Who's to say? I mean, the man it's been referenced in other things. He's been around for 400 years. He has lots of children. We've only
Oh my god, I just realized who it is. Oh my god, I know who it is. It's Talia's
son. Do you want to share or do you want
to Talia's son. It's Talia's son.
Shut up.
It's Talia's son.
I'm
calling my shot. He's Talia's son.
Okay. I called abracadabra. I'll let you have that one. We'll
it's as crazy as abracadabra, but I'm Talia's son. Oh,
and I'm bothered by how good that is. That's why it bothers me so much.
Because
that is actually really good.
Because they establish, as you say, that she, you know, much like her father, she's been around for quite some time. So yeah, she could have had a kid 30 years ago. You know, well before.
Yeah.
It works. I'm sure it's not going to happen. Oh, that would be so good. Oh wow, I'm more excited about that than the entire episode. No, I like the episode.
At the very least, the fact that it's a possibility is just like, you know, they managed to do that without really any exposition.
Yeah,
so now we have more idea.
I even though they're not really talking about it much, like either on the show or in the press, I still think the Prometheus mystery is more interesting than the, you know, who's going to die last season, which kind of really was, didn't really work out so great. But I'm going to save that for a later conversation. Say, is there anything else we want to say about this episode, or can we move on to the scores because time's a-wasting?
I have one quick thing to say.
Sure, go ahead.
The new Black Canary is Dinah Drake. Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay. We got there.
All right.
That's it.
Okay, I thought you were about to... I can't even say it yet. Okay, I'm gonna move on before something gets really screwed up for me. So let's get to the scores. Vicky, what did you think of Second Chances?
I'm going to give it a 5. Just things really worked for me this week.
I was hoping she was going to give it a 6. Damn it.
Well, but we have it, by the time Kate and Jason give the reviews, maybe she fucking will give it a 6.
Oh boy, Cade.
It's getting a 5.
Jason?
It's getting a 4.
He hates flashbacks, so it should be no surprise. Right.
Yeah, even with no Drago, he still hates flashbacks.
Dan.
I'm going to give it a 4.5. It probably would have been a 4, but I really like the way they introduced the new character, and that fight was just awesome.
Yeah. This is one of those instances, and it's happened a few times on our podcast, where I had a grade prepared before the podcast, and just talking about the episode made me view it just a little bit differently. So I am actually changing the grade. I'm glad I didn't say that. I'm going with Dan on this one. I'm going to give it a 4.5. I was initially going to give it a 4, but just thinking more about how much I enjoyed about the episode, and not my theory, I'm giving it a 4.5. Okay, so we've finished covering the 4 shows, and now it's time for something completely different.
Yeah, we've been developing this new segment for, I don't know, several hours at least. So now with
minutes and minutes.
Yes. So now we'll introduce our newest segment.
The Speedweed Hands-Off Moment of the Week.
All right, now what is the Speedweed Hands-Off Moment of the Week exactly? Well, as listeners of the podcast know, we appreciate basically Speedweed's one of the only guys we can remember his name, so we just assume that anything good that's happened this season is because of him. So these are those special moments where we just figure Speedweed, you know, 19, 20-hour day is making this stuff really good. You just kind of, you know, let something slip through the cracks. And these are those moments. So which one of these ass clowns is going first, Glass?
I believe Cade is going to be the first to... he's going to break the seal on the first Speedweed hands-off moment of the week.
Would you like me to go now?
Yes.
You ready for this?
Yes.
I would like to... My moment of the week goes to James Olsen. I've just been shot. I'm a human, but I'm a superhero. I'm going to go run out and fight some more. That was my moment. A, because I rewatched 2 shows when he came up with this thing, and I couldn't really go back and watch them again to find anything dumber.
No excuses. what you pick. Stand by it. Don't be like people changing their grade. Anyway, like I just said, I did a few minutes ago.
It's funny. It's funny you said that because I had the same thought about, and I'm not using it, but I had the same thought about when Sonos got shot with an arrow, and then like he was completely cool, like even though he got shot in the shoulder, he was like totally fine.
Yeah, his like
after that.
His meta power doesn't make him invincible, but somehow he's just like, yeah, whatever.
Vicky, I have to admit, I'm probably looking forward more to your selection than anyone else because I'm trying to imagine how you'd address this thing. So what's your pick here?
Okay, I would say Barry and Joe ragging on Iris for doing her job. They know she's a reporter. What are they gonna expect? She's just gonna, you know, sit on the sidelines and, you know, not try and go after the story. So
yeah, come on, Speed, you can do better than that.
I'm totally gonna find out if Speedweed is on the Twitter, and I will do anything I can to see if I can get like a little Skype interview with him before the end of the season. But just if he knows that we've dedicated a segment to his name, might do it. So who is next with their Speedweed hands off moment? Jason, it's you. I was just trying not to say your name, idiot.
Jason.
Okay, so it's me. Well, my moment happens to come from Arrow, and that is when Michael Holt is in the van, and he says, do I have to call myself Mr. Terrific if I'm on comms? I guess you thought that was going to be funny, but it just kind of landed with a thud.
All right, Scott, who's next? You or me?
I'd rather hear you, so you.
Okay, my moment is from The Flash when Iris and Wally go on their away mission. While breaking into the drug dealer's like lair, Iris just like picks up a metal pipe or something and just kind of like sets it on a lock, and somehow that's enough to break the lock and just goes in. So it was just completely like no force behind it at all. Not convincing.
Those warehouses are known for the security.
Oh, fucking warehouses. Tell you, if I was a showrunner for one of these shows for one season, my first commandment would be no warehouses. Sick of the warehouses. Yeah, I actually had that same thought when she did this. Like, really? Okay, at least we've been a brick. Anyway, my pick. All right, go with me here. We're getting into comic book geekiness here. I'm going with something from Arrow. The aforementioned Dinah Drake, because at first impulse, you know, a comic book guy who maybe has never seen the show before, we go, hey, cool, that's the name of the original Black Canary from the 1940s. That was her name, Dinah Drake. And then she married some guy named Larry Lance, and the name was Dinah Lance. Blah, 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 Destiny, isn't that great? There's one big problem, though. Because right now, the show is pretending that Laurel's mother didn't exist. Because Laurel's mother, hey, guess what? Her name was Dinah Lance. But guess what? Her maiden name was Drake. They already had a character named Dinah Drake on the show. So right now, we now have another woman named Dinah Drake on the show. So I guess the bonehead writers thought they could just do that and no one would find that strange. Busted fuckers. It's strange. Lame.
Flashpoint. That's all I'm saying.
What, they changed her name? I guess
yes,
they can change
yes, that's what I'm saying. Flashpoint.
Lame.
Pretty sure that Dinah's mother was born before Flashpoint happened.
Doesn't matter. Flashpoint changed it.
Well, technically, Diggle's kid was born before that, too, so it's Ripples. Doesn't matter. Lame.
Either way, it was a really good week for the show. These shows, so Speedweed, you did a damn good job. But some of your people, a little sloppy, so don't let him get away with it. You want to feel your hand upon these shows all the time.
You know, he may want to weed those people out. I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm. Like,
what are you, Jason?
I know. Maybe I've been smoking some of that weed. Okay, good. All right. That's when you know it's time to end the podcast. So, with that
hopping to the end here.
If you enjoyed this podcast, and hopefully you enjoyed at least 98% of it, you'll probably enjoy joining our Facebook group as well. It's a Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can find us that way. like the page, join the conversation about shows like this and even better ones. You can also find us on iTunes. We're a Serious TV Drama Podcast. Subscribe to our feed there, as well as rate and review us there. 5-star ratings are very much appreciated. 1-star is not so much. And you can follow us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. And, this is usually the point where someone hopefully doesn't screw up what his running gag has become. What is it, Jason?
Hey, it's gag-worthy. Believe me. I can't fuck it up this time. There, I dropped my F-bomb for tonight.
I'm so tempted just to say it before he does, if he's not just going to say it.
Episode 155.
There, stop that from happening. Quit rambling, it's late.
Oh, I neglected. Vicky, you do a quick little plug for your website that helps to promote the show as well?
Yes, I share our podcast on Pop Cult HQ, where you can listen, find it there, and all kinds of other pop culture news.
Excellent. Guess what, guys? We just had all five of us together covering 4 really good episodes this week, and plus a new segment, and we got it done in roughly the same amount of time as we did last week with one less person, and not such a good segment. So congratulations to all of us here. And thank you all for participating, as always. And I will say goodnight to all the folks out there as well.
Good night.
Glad to be back, everybody.
Good night.
He's the monarch of motion, the sultan of speed, the wizard of wizzle. Yes, indeed. Go from here to China in a no time flat, beat the speed of light, and you can't beat that. The Flash,
the Flash,
meet the mighty Flash.
The Flash, the Flash,
in a fight he'll smash and crash, smash a whole gang of crooks or schnooks. Hey, he'll just clobber any kind of bad guy, thief or robber, the world's fastest human. Yeah, man, the Flash,
the unbeatable Flash.
No one knows Barry Allen is his real name, works with the police, justice is his aim, wears a ring with the Flash's uniform in it. When danger threatens, he'll switch in a minute. The Flash,
the Flash,
meet the mighty Flash.
The Flash, the Flash,
in a fight he'll